So I work at Google, contributing to the Mozilla project, primarily to Firefox. And I continue to do the sort of work that I've done for the past few years, which is to play an active role in the development of new versions of Firefox. From the early stages of each release cycle, where we figure out what we want out of the next release, through the planning, documentation, and development, bug fixing, and release. So, a whole bunch of different things.
Great. And how did you come to work at Google for Mozilla?
So, towards the end of 2004, we were shipping Firefox 1.0, and it was around that time that I had come in contact with several of the engineers here at Google, and just was generally impressed by the enthusiasm of the people here, even over things that I thought superficially were boring tasks. And they seemed to make everything fun. And it wasn't long before, in the process of working with them on these things, that they sort of became fun for me too. And I thought that that was sort of infectious. And I thought maybe, after working with, working closely with the same set of people for the, previous number of years, which was about, 4 years, or maybe slightly more at the time, that, if I were to come and work at Google, I could potentially still work with those people, but then also be exposed to a whole bunch of new people with, different ideas and enthusiasm. So, and that was one of the reasons why I chose to come here.
Okay. So how does that work? How they pay you, though, to work on Mozilla projects. How did that come about?
So towards the end of 2004, I sent a note to somebody I knew here and saying that I was interested in anything that they might have. And it turned out that Google was interested in Firefox. They liked the product, and they thought it would be good to support its development. So eventually they hired myself and several other people from the Mozilla community to continue development on it.
Okay, great. When did you first start working with computers?
Not until I was older than most people around here. I think I got my first computer when I was about 12 or 13 years old. It was an Apple II. It was sort of a hand-me-down from relatives. I used that for a while until it broke. And then I had I think when I was about 14, I got a 486, and that basically didn't do anything interesting at all. Played a couple of games and ran Windows 3.1, and was not anything like the stuff that we have these days, or even not necessarily my friends had. So I did just made the best of what I had with that, and played around with teaching myself to program with Excel scripts and stuff like that, which was all that was on the machine.
Hmm.
So that was about, 13 to 14 was about the age that I got into this.
And when, what's the first programming project you worked on?
I sort of got into programming from an interesting angle, although one that's probably becoming more common these days, and that I was interested in having my own, I wanted to make my own website. So I began to write HTML because it seemed easy enough to figure out. And then, just reading some computer magazines, I found tips about JavaScript, which is more of a programming language than HTML. Began to make my website more elaborate, interesting, WYSI effects and that sort of stuff. And over time, that sort of grew, and the website became bigger and bigger, until I sort of switched over to contributing to Mozilla.
Hmm. And to which Mozilla projects have you worked on?
So I got involved with Mozilla because I was sort of curious as to what had happened with Netscape. Netscape had announced that it had released its source code to the public in 1998. And I'd sort of looked at it at the time, but didn't think there was any way I could contribute to it because it was too difficult to work on given my current set of skills. So I came back to the project to see what was going on about a year later in 1999 and saw that that they had switched gears a little bit and were now working on a new version of the application that was written in languages much more familiar to web developers, and sort of XML, JavaScript type things for the user interface. So I began contributing to that, trying, because they basically rewrote the entire application from the ground up. And so most of the user interface was either buggy or sort of in poor shape or not there. And so I figured I could probably help with this, given my experience with web development. So I sort of got involved with that and figuring out, you know, helping to figure out what some of the syntactic elements of the Zool language were and so on. And it was from that work that I got a job offer from Netscape. And I went to work for Netscape in the browser group and worked on a number of different application features there for a long while. And then, you know, a bunch of different internal projects after Mozilla sort of began to lose favor within that company. And then after that, onto Firefox.
Right. So it sounds like you've sort of had a variety of roles within different projects. Is that right?
It's been mostly worked on the browser for the past 6 or so years, but you know, have worked on different things within the browser, you know, different browser functionality pieces, and on, you know, ultimately different browsers. You know, the back in 1999 through 2002 or so, you know, I was working on you know, what's now called SeaMonkey, or what shipped as Netscape 6 and 7, before eventually switching gears to work on Firefox, and then, you know, various other things along the way.
Great. Do you generally work alone, or within small groups, or within larger groups?
It depends. I mean, if I'm working on a sort of a fairly self-contained feature, then, you know, I can probably do it myself, although there is a, you know, a testing community that, you know, as you make changes, will report bugs back and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But for more ambitious features, it's usually, you know, a small group of people, maybe, you know, 3 or 5 at most, for certain things. Right now I'm working on features with about, I guess, 4 or 5 other people, since it's significant enough in complexity.
And are those people usually located locally or remotely?
It depends. I mean, for the one feature I mentioned where I'm working with a large number of people, those people are all here, and people paid by Google to work on Firefox. And so, you know, that's one thing. But for some of the other features, it's a matter of, for instance, if I'm working on a feature that's part of the user interface, but the user interface requires some feature from some other part of the code, then, you know, I will go and find that person and try and, you know, figure out a way to get that thing done. And that person who maintains the other section of code, you know, may work, may not, you know, may be a student in, you know, some other country or something like that. So it's a matter of using the project's communication infrastructure to, you know, locate the right person.
Mm-hmm. And who's usually in charge when there's so many different people working on one thing?
So there's sort of with respect to Firefox and the Firefox sort of release process, you know, there are a set of people that sort of work together to try and make decisions and organize things. Like, you know, at the start of each release, we sort of sit down and figure out what we want out of it. And then, you know, people sign up for tasks and you know, take on the role of making sure that what they've signed up for gets done. And if that means that they need to work with, you know, 3 different people to get that done, then, you know, they need to drive that. You know, according to aside from that, which is sort of the, you know, practice, the operational side, Mozilla works on sort of what they call a benevolent dictator model in open source, which means that each little subsection of code is called a module and has an owner and peers. And basically the owner and peers are the set of people that do coordinate the work and get it done, with the owner basically, you know, making decisions where consensus cannot be reached and all that sort of stuff. So within the context of the Firefox browser user interface, I am the module owner.
Oh, okay. Great. How do you generally communicate with people you're working on?
So right now, it depends on the project. Like, for instance, if someone is, you know, far away, it will be through IRC or email. People are nearby, it'll just be, you know, hallway chat. But, you know, what I've been trying to do lately, and my most recent communications have sort of been of this sort, is to try and get more discussion into the project news groups and mailing lists so that we have sort of an archival record of all of the decisions that have been made, because it can be difficult if, you know, a year from now you're trying to figure out why you did something and you might forget the discussion that you had. So that's sort of where I'd like to see things head, and where I've sort of been poking things along in the past month or so.
Is it generally working, you think, or
I think it'll take some time, because, you know, one of the things about open source projects, especially when you have an open source project that's started by a company like Netscape, there are different worlds, and when you are a commercial entity and you have a bunch of people who are used to working in a, you know, closed environment, you know, on a particular campus in the same building, you know, on the same floor, the convenience of being able to walk over and talk to somebody about something is very, you know, it should not be understated how powerful that is. And so as a result, you know, from the very start of the project, you know, when Netscape was significantly involved, it was difficult to get people to sort of more fully engage with the community. In fact, that sort of, that culture sort of followed the project, and I know that, you know, myself, there have been times when, you know, I have done that sort of thing, and, you know, it just makes it very difficult later on to figure out what's gone on.
Where do the code contributors work on the code?
How do you mean, where do they?
I don't know what I mean.
Well, I think what we're getting at is sort of what you were saying about sort of maybe expand a little bit upon the ownership and how it's determined who's going to be on which teams of on which modules. Is it strictly voluntary? How is it decided who's going to be the owner of the module? How is it going to decide who's going to be a peer? And what is the working relationship like?
So I think people, as far as people joining projects, people join projects that they're interested in, and, you know, they'll help out where they think they have skill and or have something to contribute. Sometimes if, you know, people work for a company and that company is interested in contributing to Mozilla, that company may have interest in a particular product or feature, and thus will pay its employees to work on that particular task. You know, someone may pay someone to work on Thunderbird, but not Firefox, for instance. As far as the actual sort of, you know, the leadership, what generally happens is, when there is a case where there are sections of code that are not clearly owned or not being well owned, the sort of organizational structure that sits above all of the Mozilla projects, like Firefox, Thunderbird, etc., so the Mozilla organization / foundation, I guess, at this point, will take, you know, nominations for who the new owner is to be, and if there's sometimes discussion and, you know, people agree or disagree, etc. But usually it's the case that, you know, there is a section of code and it's been unowned for some time, or somebody else, it's been unowned and somebody else has stepped up and began acting like the owner, and, you know, basically been reviewing patches and producing new code and keeping that code alive. And so someone will say, well, why don't we just make this person the owner? And, you know, usually the case is, well, yeah, it looks like that person's the owner anyway, so we'll just make it so. And so that usually happens.
Do you have maybe you can think of a specific example of how, of a module where that's kind of played out?
Well, most recently, I think, example has been the Java to XBCon bridge, which is a thing that allows code written in Java to talk through XBCon to other Mozilla components and services. And there was some old code in the Mozilla source tree called Blackwood, which I don't believe was being, or at least wasn't as up-to-date as it could be. And I think somebody from IBM, Javier Pedamonte, had written a new one, and he was actively developing that. And so people thought that he should be the owner of this thing. And so there was a brief discussion, and it was made so. We have a tool for tracking what all of the modules are, what code those modules contain, and who the owner peers and members are. And that system is called Despot. So somebody went and made that change in that system, and now he's the owner.
Who manages the desktop system?
I'm not sure. I think a couple of people at Mozilla, Brendan, Mike Shaver, those are people that know how to add and edit people in that system.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, individual owners can, if you're the owner of module, you can manage your own module. You can, you know, add peers, people from the community who have been volunteering a lot and, you know, making significant contributions. You can make them peers and stuff like that. But as far as sort of the meta, these people at Mozilla.
Hmm. Interesting. How important are the comments that are within the code? Do you use those as a way of communicating, like, instead of, I don't know, any other means, or?
So, for a long time, one, just sort of personal editorial, I don't think Mozilla code is commented enough, and you know, I've sort of contributed to that as well over the years and been trying to improve it, just from having to go back in later years and read and figure out what's going on. But there was never a tool for documentation on a website that was easy enough to use that developers would use it as they wrote code. So typically, the code is sort of, you know, where there are comments, those comments are documentation for the code. If someone went the extra mile and wrote actual web page documentation for how things work, that's sort of a, you know, within Mozilla at this stage at least, that's sort of an unusual thing. So a lot of the comments are to either themselves, people to themselves, or to, you know, other contributors as to, you know, how this stuff works.
Mm-hmm. Do people ever go back and make comments later?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you find people, you look through a file and you'll see some code that's very old that might date from, you know, when the project was, when this version of the application was still getting started back in 99, for instance, and very, very old code that's maybe a little messy or not well documented, and there'll be a comment later on from somebody saying, you know, what does this do? Or, you know, what sort of stuff, you know, maybe in the hopes that someone will come along, someone else who knows might come along and either document it better or improve it. So yeah, sometimes there are notes like that, or just sort of, you know, often editorial comments like, this is a really bad way of doing this, this sucks, or something like that. You know, as a mental note to the person that maintains that file, that the next time they come through they should consider optimizing or something like that.
Can you think of a time where that ever led to a significant change, you know, if a comment like that?
I'm not sure. I mean, usually they're over relatively small things, because a lot of the, you know, major, you know, changes or re-architectures and lots of stuff have been tracked outside of the code. Like, there were, you know, back in, after Netscape 6, Netscape 6 shipped and was very slow and buggy, and there was a significant effort after that within Netscape developer team to improve the performance, for instance. So a lot of those optimization things, or at least the really massive ones with huge impact, were identified and filed through the bug system and then tackled that way.
And are comments ever misused in any way, however you want to define misused?
People sometimes write bad comments. You know, if someone, you know, if say you have some code that says I plus one, there might be a comment that says increment I, which is not really that helpful because, well, the code clearly says that. You know, generally saying, it's, you know, not all comments say what the code is supposed to do. Sometimes they say what it does do, which is, in that particular example, that's what it does do. It doesn't really sort of give you a, an overview of what the intent is. And the intent is usually what's more important when you're trying to find bugs, because you're trying to figure out what it should be doing and comparing that with the actual code. And sometimes you get so deep into the set of code that it's difficult to figure out what the intent was. The idea is, to some extent, that code be self-documenting and that people choose good names for variables and functions so that you can read through the code, and assuming you have a basic knowledge of the vocabulary of the system, that you can figure it out. But that's not always the case. And there isn't always sort of that sort of overview documentation that establishes that vocabulary.
How, just generally, how would you describe your programming style?
What do you mean by style?
I guess I don't know, however you think you would.
Maybe a better way to put it is, have you ever clashed with other programmers over a way of working, or not so much a particular aspect of the code, but a kind of a workflow or a work style.
I mean, over a period of time, certainly there have been incidences. People have, you know, everybody has different expectations and different ways of working, and sometimes it's easy, especially when a lot of communication is done electronically, for subtlety of, or humor or anything like that, senses of humor to be lost in transmission. So if you say something in a way that's incompatible with the way something else works, with the way that they themselves develop, they might take offense. There's that, and there's just, legitimate things where, either I've been wrong, or, I've learned something from an experience, or the other person's been wrong and has learned from something from the experience. So probably, countless examples over the years, since, this is pretty much the only project I've worked on while being a software engineer. So
how are conflicts between different people, how are they resolved? Between peers, let's say.
But typically people try to, there can be argument, but, ultimately at the end of the day, either sort of fizzles or people sometimes step back and take a look at it from another angle, or somebody else who, if people are arguing on a public list or in an IRC channel with other people, someone else might come along and offer a different perspective, which either causes them to join the argument or for the other two people to sort of stop and think about it for a moment and either continue arguing or stop. And then, people either form a difference of opinion or they resolve or come to a conclusion. So that's, I think those are some of the things that I've noticed.
Great.
Great. Do you generally work on assembly language portions of the code, or JavaScript and XML?
Mostly JavaScript and XML, although some level of C++, because there's a very small amount of code implemented in assembly language, which just handles connecting functions in JavaScript to C++. But most of the backend rendering and all that sort of stuff is done in C++, most of the user interface in JavaScript. So sometimes working on a user interface feature, I might need a feature in the backend, so I may implement it myself, or somebody else may do it. But since most of my work is in user interface, it's mostly JavaScript, XML.
And are those boundaries between sort of the backend and the front end, the C++ and the JavaScript, XML, are those hard and fast? I mean, you mentioned that you kind of cross into the C++ things if you need to do something. Are there sort of boundary conflicts, territorial?
I don't think so much territorial. I think there are, people, this is what I've learned over the years through, at times being very, isolationist, or, working on specific features and then needing something and going and, producing a patch. I don't think people are territorial. I think people like to know, people who work in these in other parts of the code. Actually, this is true for everybody, people like to know when you would like to make a change to their code, even before you start writing it, so that they can think about it and think, well, one, is this a good idea or not? Two, what might some good ways of doing this be? So that, they can help you come up with the best idea, best way of proceeding, and so that they're, ready for review when your patch comes along. They can review it and they sort of have a sense of knowledge of how this works, rather than, being surprised by one, a completely new feature that they'd never considered before, with an unknown design, that they then have to not only figure out just from your set of changes, but, also give technical commentary on. So people like to be told first. Otherwise, people can be sort of irritated. And, I appreciate that because, people have produced stuff like that and, you know, thrown it over the wall to me to review it. So I've been sort of irritated. So I think that's sort of the level of conflict you get across different module boundaries.
And do you see that there's any kind of cultural differences between people who work on the rendering engine and people who work on the user interface? Are there a difference in the kinds of people who get involved in one or the other, or in other aspects of the project?
So I think that there are definitely cultural variances across Mozilla contributors. I don't know if it necessarily maps to front or back end.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, with respect to a number of developers on Firefox over the years, the sort of ideology of those folks, including myself, has been very practical, results oriented, and in terms of getting things done really quickly. And whereas other folks may take a more relaxed, laid back attitude to it, like I'm working on these changes, and I'm going to get them done on whatever time, however long it takes. And if they don't make this next release, then it doesn't really bother me, so I'll just wait for the next one. Whereas the case for Firefox, it's always been, we've been trying to figure out exactly how much we can cram into each release. And it may also, that sort of stuff may also break down based on how much time you spend on a project. If you're just volunteering a little in your spare time, then, you're not going to necessarily be able to get something into a certain release. So you may sort of accept that up front and not stress out too much about it. Whereas if you're working full time on something, then you may be more inclined to do so. That's one thing. And just to add more detail to that, I think some people are more product, or what's one word, or another word is result oriented, than other folk who are just doing, the what they do and what they get out of it is sort of the intellectual challenge and stimulation, intellectual stimulation from actually writing code or figuring out the answer to an interesting problem. And other people are trying to say, how does this affect the bottom line, to use a corporate term, but how does this improve usability, or how does this make, how does this improve our standards compliance, or any number of different things.
And which camp would you put yourself into?
I tend to, just by necessity have to be more focused on what things I can try and get done right now, versus what things I would like to do. And sometimes I feel a little sad about that because, a number of years ago when I was more of a free agent before I started working for Netscape, I could go and pick any project I wanted to do, even if it wasn't necessarily that important. And I could pay some attention to that and explore or research. And sort of the trade-off, when you have people who are all focused on what's going to happen next and what the highest priority thing is that some of the small details are lost, the interesting projects, the little side things that don't seem important, but maybe they might seem important later on. Those sort of things are lost. So I think it's good that there is this variance, because there are people looking at all angles.
And just to sort of finish up on this line, what kind of most interests you about the your user interface work? Why that? Why not something else?
Well, I mean, I certainly enjoy working in other parts of the code, because a lot of sections of code are easier to test than user interface. I mean, if you're working on something that just takes a set of data and produces another set of data, you can write unit tests for it and be very confident that it works well. User interface is harder in that respect. But also, I tend to be very, I like building things that I can see, and making things that look nice. And by nice, I mean, I think I'm very fussy over little details, even down to like a pixel on the screen where a line is. If it's slightly to the left or slightly to the right, where does it look right, and creating balance and that sort of stuff. So I like to be able to, getting sort of the instant gratification too that you get when you put something together that you can see, is what I think interests me about doing user interface. And then, like, on top of that, it's, like I said, the fuzziness and attention to detail in making it work better and more reliably and seem more complete or high quality than previous versions or other products or et cetera.
So, to sort of change gears a little bit, what to what extent do you think Mozilla and Firefox in particular maybe really relies on the work of volunteers?
I mean, I think ultimately completely, because I mean certainly companies supply, you know, developers. I mean, there are several people here that work on Firefox. You know, the Mozilla Corporation itself is a corporation that pays a bunch of people to contribute to, you know, a bunch of different Mozilla projects. But I think a lot of the spirit, or, you know, yeah, I guess that's a good word for it, comes from the fact that, you know, Mozilla projects are, you know, community developed. And, you know, I think that that will be, you know, as soon as Mozilla software just becomes another corporate thing, I think some of the advantage that some people perceive from it might be lost. You know, I think people see Mozilla as sort of an independent organization without maybe as many of its, you know, without sinister motivations or anything like that. You know, someone who's sort of looking out for you with nothing to really gain from it, but, you know, your trust. So I think the fact, you know, the community development plays into that. And also the community, you know, a lot of developers from different parts of the world contribute. You know, I started as a volunteer. You know, a lot of people who work on Mozilla today started as, who are paid to work on Mozilla started as volunteers. You talk to Brian, he started as a volunteer implementing mouse wheel, scroll mouse wheel support for the browser. So, engineering contributions, and then there are, you know, hundreds and thousands of people who download every, you know, really crazy buggy nightly build in between releases and test, you know, run and subject their bookmarks to the abuse that we're putting them through right now, all that sort of stuff, and, you know, report bugs. And, you know, when bugs are filed, there are people that, you know, have, you know, the entire bug system, it seems, you know, all 300,000 bugs in their heads. So when someone files a bug, they can say, oh, that's a duplicate of that one, and just, you know, close it out and keep the system in check so that developers can get work done in terms of, you know, and be able to work effectively. And managers can, you know, see useful bug lists and not ones that are thousands long. So that QA effort is mostly community, as is localization. I mean, Firefox has many localizations, and those are aside, the only one that's sort of developed by the developers who work at various companies is the English one, and then all of the other languages are produced by independent volunteer teams that at a certain point in the release cycle are given the go-ahead to start translating all of the strings, and then they produce a localization, and that becomes the official one for their language. So, you know, there's lots of different places, and I think without a lot of those different things, I don't think Firefox would necessarily have the reach or quality or any of this sort of stuff. I think we'd probably, you know, without the people who help in testing, bug management side, the engineers would probably have all pulled their hair out and gone on to something simpler. So,
why do you think people volunteer?
Well, one, it's just the reach is such that it's an interesting project to work on, because you have the ability to help shape the future of a product that, you know, lots of people use. And, you know, Mozilla software has lots of users, not just Firefox. You know, Thunderbird is probably a couple of million users, and you know, same with Camino on Mac. You know, these products are, you know, well received and reviewed and pressed and that sort of stuff, so it's fun and cool to work on that sort of thing. It's also software that we all use every day. So, you know, sometimes I thought, you know, maybe it would be more interesting to work on something else. I mean, certainly Google has lots of interesting projects, and, you know, Google has products that are, you know, fascinating, like Maps and stuff like that. But I think about it, and I think this is software that, you know, we all use every day. It doesn't really... It feels like one of the most important things that you can contribute to. The other thing is, I think it's just, you know, web browsers are really complex problems, and some people like to work on really complex problems. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different aspects to them, not just the user interface. I mean, all of the rendering engine, getting, you know, making sure that you are both standards compliant and, you know, acceptably fast. There's, you know, lots of tough problems there and interesting, you know, research angles and lots of stuff. So I think, you know, people contribute for different reasons, but those are some that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find that people who contribute have different reasons for contributing, for volunteering, kind of have different goals and perhaps clash over the reasons why, you know, if they have a different vision because of why they're doing?
Certainly. I mean, if someone is, you know, think about it. I mean, if someone's goal is to create the, you know, most standards compliant system, then, you know, implementing something that is not a standard might seem to be outside their goals or might even seem bad to them. You know, one example to look at for this sort of thing is XForms. XForms is a specification that defines how web forms should work in sort of an XML-like way rather than as they exist in HTML right now. And it's supposedly supposed to be a companion specification to XHTML, which is an XML version of HTML. But XHTML has no built-in forms, I don't think. It was designed to rely on XForms. And so there are people who think that, you know, that should be implemented and that should be the way to go. And then there are other people who say, well, standards compliance is important, but we may not necessarily need to implement every standard, or we may choose to do something that's more practical so that existing web page developers don't need to rewrite their entire site using this new technology, but can make a few small changes to get the same effect. And, you know, there can be heated discussions between the two people. You know, some of the standards, you know, the XForm side might say, well, by doing this, you're effectively undermining our technology. And, you know, the people say, well, no one's going to adopt your technology. And then, you know, there's these arguments form. And, you know, eventually someone, you know, either they'll work it out themselves, or if it's too polarized, you know, there are you know, like I said, the decision-making structure within Mozilla will come along and say, okay, well, considering all of this, we say this one. So...
Mm-hmm. So I understand that during the early development of Firefox, CVS access was limited to a small team mm-hmm. of workers. Why was the access restricted in that way?
So I think the reason for that was that, and I think, you know, just my personal feeling is that probably wasn't the best thing to do in retrospect, but it was sort of a response to the way the SeaMonkey product had developed over time, and that was that SeaMonkey itself was a collection of different pieces. There was the browser, mail, etc., but also within a single piece, the browser, there were different parts, like you know, sidebar and bookmarks and all sorts of stuff. And each of these things were separate modules, and after Netscape sort of disengaged from the development process, it was never clear who managed any of that and how it would be managed. And as a result, it just became subject to sort of incremental change, but without really any combined direction. And so lots of small changes went in, and the browser bloated a little over time. And it wasn't particularly good with Netscape, because my personal opinion is that the Netscape UI was pretty bad for 6 and 7. It was based very much on Netscape 4, which was already kind of bloated. It had a bunch more stuff thrown in to appease the requirements of Netscape.com. And the rest of it was kind of overwrought, because within Netscape, you know, with 100 or so engineers, you know, an engineer might be assigned to work on a small part of the world, and that would be the only thing that they would do. And so they would, you know, over-engineer some, you know, all these things sort of grew as massively over-engineered pieces. And so then that was sort of left, and rather than considering the sort of mass of you know, not very efficient user interface. People just sort of set about continuing to work on it and add to it, all that sort of stuff. And it was very chaotic because the only because there was no clear either sort of product requirements or product plan or any sort of vision for what that should look like. The standard rules for checking in code applied, which meant that anyone who had review and a second review could check in. So things were happening all over the place, and it was just growing, and it was crazy. And so the idea was to create a new place in the CVS repository that prevented this from happening by restricting the check-in list. Although in retrospect, the very act of forking, as it was, the user interface, was probably enough to prevent people from checking in and establishing, you know, rules for who should review code and all sorts of stuff. So I think what the you know, putting that restriction on there probably did was go a little bit too far and effectively say, we don't want you, which is not really the case.
Hmm.
But
so how was it decided early on who would participate?
So basically, it was just a bunch of people on IRC got together and were talking about it. I know that you know, a number of us had expressed dissatisfaction with the Mozilla product and Netscape products, and were thinking about what could be done better. And Dave Hyatt had started what is now called Camino, which was a separate browser, and
mm-hmm.
you know, designed just to be a nice streamlined user interface. And so, you know, he thought it would be a good idea to do the same thing in Zool, which is the XML language, and for Windows and Linux. Later, it turned out it worked on Mac too. So there was sort of a discussion, and just the set of people that played that participated in that discussion joined the initial project. And I think Brendan was in that IRC channel, and so he just went about setting up the module and desktop and all that sort of stuff. And then, you know, we were able to check in code.
Hmm.
Start
so how did access restrictions change over time? It's become more open?
So later on, I guess around, maybe it was late 2003 or early 2004, it was clear that this system, well, one, was causing people to be sort of, you know, it caused, the very fact that there was this access restriction was causing there to be division within the community. It was like, what makes these people think that they're better than anybody else? And then also the fact that changes would happen in the back end that would lead to changes being required by the front end, like an API would change for user interface or something like that. And so the people that made the change in the back end were very diligent about making sure that the CMonkey front end was updated because they could, because they could have access to the code. Whereas with Firefox, they couldn't. So changes would get made and Firefox would break. So, you know, it just wasn't an efficient way of working. When people make API changes, people need to be able to patch across the entire code base. And so, you know, with these things in mind, the restrictions were lifted. And what should have been done in the first place, which is basic review rules, were put into effect, which basically stated if you want to change this code, you need to get review from either a module owner or a peer. And, you know, if you're just making small changes, like if you're fixing a spelling mistake, or if you're, you know, changing an API or something like that in 100 places across the entire source tree, just a review for the entire change. We don't need to necessarily look at it then, because you're not doing anything that's specific to Firefox. You're just, you know, renaming function foo to function bar. So
mm-hmm.
as long as someone reviews the change, it doesn't matter. So that sort of covered all of the bases, really, and made it seem less exclusionary. But I think, you know, still to an extent, some of that's followed the project for, you know, until today.
Oh, really? In what ways?
I just think, you know, people have, a negative opinion of the way Firefox is developed. And, you know, people who work on CMonkey, for instance, CMonkey is a very inclusive process in terms of, you know, allowing people to contribute changes and that sort of stuff. And you can read some of their documentation. They have a reasons page that talks about, you know, some of the problems that they see with Firefox development. And, you know, I think that some of the things that they say are correct. And, you know, I think we should all try and fix them. and some of the other ones I would disagree. So there you go.
How about other Mozilla projects? What's your impression of those in those same terms? Is where on the spectrum do those lie in between the sort of Sea Monkey and the Firefox models?
So I think, for instance, Camino is a very collaborative community process for that one. But you know, there was, I think, enough intelligent and opinionated people at the core of that project that it doesn't go off the rails. They have a mailing list, and there's lots of discussion on that, and people talk about what they'd like to see and that sort of stuff. And then there are community leaders, like Mike Pinkerton, who actually works here at Google and is here this week. Other people within that community that are sort of leaders that steer the discussion and make sure that, bad things aren't accepted or all that sort of stuff. So I think that works quite well for them. It's like, it's sort of, I think that's sort of the right mix of having an inclusive process, but also being careful not to let things become unstuck. Then there are other projects. I mean, Thunderbird, I'm not sure what the developer, I think Scott McGregor uses, I'm not sure what communications infrastructure he uses for that. But I know he works full-time on it, as does David Bienfinet, both who work for the Mozilla Corporation. And then there are volunteers, and I'm not sure what the primary communication model for them is, if it's a mailing list or if it's a forum on a website or something like that. So I don't know if you're speaking to him, but he would know more.
This is not on our list, but it follows from some of what you said. I was interested. How does a project like Firefox deal with a situation if a leader drops out, if someone who, or Camino or something else, like if someone who does provide that sort of central vision and that kind of direction, that strong leadership, how is that person replaced, or and what is the fallout, or have you had that experience?
So I think it's interesting because I've been reading a book lately which I've been enjoying, which is called Producing Open Source Software by Carl Fogel. And it talks about these two models. So at least it talks about the benevolent dictator model, and it talks about another model that's used elsewhere by other projects. And it says sort of over time, projects transition from benevolent dictator into this more democratic system. And I don't know. I mean, I think Firefox may have actually been the reverse of that. If you look at SeaMonkey and the way SeaMonkey was developed back in 2002 or so, that was sort of a very, if you wanted to change something, if you got the required approvals, you could. And sort of transitioned to the system of being more sort of benevolent dictator style. But I think that if a leader, or if a single leader leaves, I think the other people in the peers group will probably take over those responsibilities. Either some one person will step up, or as a group that they will handle it. Those are the two options, I guess. I don't think anyone, completely aside from or has never been involved would step in. Or someone who is not known to the peers group would step in. I think that the leadership has to come from within that.
And do people drop out? I mean, do people disappear? And
sometimes. Not typically for any of the application front ends, the products themselves. But sometimes for, individual submodules, people, either due to time commitment or something else, they will go away. Sometimes they'll come back 6 months later or something like that. Sometimes they'll disappear for good. In that case, whatever code they work on is either taken over by somebody else, there may have been several people working on it, or the code will begin to sort of stagnate a little bit until somebody else comes along that can work on it.
So kind of switching gears here, why do you think Mozilla, and in particular Mozilla Firefox, has been able to attract such a large number of users?
I don't know the exact answer. I think it's probably a combination of different things. I mean, from an engineering point of view, I'd like to say that it's because it offers better features or is in some way more compelling as a product. I think there's an amount of that. I think it filled a need from the market at a certain time. People became dissatisfied by Internet Explorer and its security issues and pop-up ads and all that sort of stuff. Also, I can't help but think that the community marketing may I think that that's had a positive effect, and all of the buzz that it's had in the press as a result of that and a few other initiatives, like New York Times ads and all that sort of stuff. And then also there's this sort of, I mentioned before about Mozilla and it sort of seeming like an independent entity. There's that, I think, which might help. It seems like it's not produced by a company that wants to, find a way. This is really part of some secret agenda to figure out some way to sell you something. And then also this sort of this aura around Firefox. I think it is a really well-crafted combination of name, and I think the Firefox name is probably the one of the best names I've heard for any Mozilla software, and the sort of imagery icon, the logo. And I think those things, work well together, and people have sort of anthropomorphized sometimes and talk about Firefox as a person or something that they relate to. I was talking to Brett Wilson, who I work with, he said that his girlfriend talked about Firefox versus Internet Explorer, and she said Firefox crashed too much. But she said that the way she characterized it was that Firefox was very moody, and Internet Explorer was a robot. And I think some people, the sort of draw for some people was that, that it seems more, it's more something that they can relate to. I don't know how or why. It's maybe something intangible. The name itself is interesting, the story behind that. The name was originally Phoenix to signify sort of rising from the ashes of Netscape and all that sort of stuff. And that turned out that Phoenix Technologies, a company that makes BIOS and stuff like that, didn't want us to use that name, so it had to change. And so we chose something similar sounding, which was Firebird, which is similar to Phoenix. And that was also used by another open source project, so we had to change it again. These are unfortunate problems to have to solve, especially when you're picking up users. So we had to figure out a new name, and we spent about 2 weeks, and these 2 weeks were, there wasn't a lot of engineering done at that time. They were sort of beating heads against walls, and, I read the dictionary, trying to find, words, and, we came up with about three of them, and they all were terrible, until Jason Kersey, who is the maintainer of the Mozilla Zine community news website, was just running through a bunch of words that started with fire. He was going, Firecat, Firefox. And then I said, Firefox. And then I went and looked it up in the U.S. Patent Trademark Office website to see if anyone had trademarks on it in software. And I don't think there were any. And I said, that sounds really good. And he wasn't even serious. Like I said, I wasn't serious. That's a dumb name. Then I said, no, I think it's great. And so we told it to the people, Mitchell and so on, and she went and, went and did a formal investigation. As a group, we sort of sat down and looked at a bunch of different, we looked at about three different names. I can't remember what they all were. I think Firecat was one of them, Firefox, Firecat, Firefly, and tried to pick the best one, and we as a group decided Firefox was the best one. And so she went and did lots more investigation and found out, where there were potential issues and solved them all. And then I think the foundation applied for the trademark so that we'd never have this problem again. So yeah. That's sort of that's how that name came about.
Okay, it's very interesting. What do you think sets Firefox apart from other Mozilla projects? Maybe in terms of being able to track large number of users. I know there are other projects that have attracted a large number, but not quite in the same way that Firefox has been able to.
I think Firefox solves a problem that a lot of people, solves a sort of pain points that a lot of people were experiencing, like some of the things I mentioned with Internet Explorer, security and pop-up ads and all that sort of stuff. And I think Firefox provides a relatively convenient solution for those. And one of the things with Firefox that I tried to really stress was making the transition easy. So we made sure that our import wasn't just, you know, whatever, you know, previous versions of Netscape had, importing IE favorites and all that sort of stuff, but actually going and trying to understand what stumbling blocks would be to people's adoption, like bringing, if people had saved all of their passwords in IE's password manager, if they came over to Firefox and they tried to log into their sites, we wouldn't remember it. And if they'd forgotten their passwords, then they'd have to go back to IE to get into the site. So we figured out a way to import everyone's passwords and all that sort of stuff, you know, to make sure that that transition was seamless, so that since people experience this pain, we can offer them a solution and say that the, you know, cost or difficulty for you to make this change is so close to zero that it doesn't really matter. And so that's sort of been our focus. Other, you know, another place is like, you know, Camino has more of a, more trouble, I guess, attracting users than Firefox, even though I think Camino has higher market share on Mac than Firefox has on Windows. I'm not sure if that's true. I can't remember. But just because of the fact that, you know, the default browser on Macintosh isn't, you know, doesn't subject users to as much pain. I mean, Safari's a decent browser, so, you know, people use Camino, you know, only if Safari doesn't meet their needs, and Safari meets a lot more needs than IE does. You know, the same problem that Thunderbird has is that a lot of people use webmail these days, or, you know, email client is often, you know, mandated and rolled out by your IS department and stuff like that. It's not something that you can necessarily configure easily because you need to know all of your settings and put them all in and that sort of stuff. So, you know, those are some reasons, I think, why they may not have attracted as high user counts. But, you know, I think over time, either those projects will come up with more or compelling features, or migration will be easier, or, you know, fundamental user behavioral patterns will change, or, you know, something. So,
I just want to just interrupt ourselves here for a minute. I don't want to keep you here too long. If I want to keep an eye on the
okay,
time.
Okay. So, I mean, what sort of, how long is your list of questions?
We've got a bunch more, but we can shorten things. If, do you want to say we'll be done by 11? Is that
okay? That's good. Then we can go and find, I think, Darren, you're talking to next.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Okay, yeah, maybe we'll skip around a bit. But, okay, so how would you compare Mozilla's vision in 1998 with the present reality?
I'm not even sure what Mozilla's, let me think about what their vision was then. I think, you know, when the source was released, at the very beginning, the intent was to just provide source. And then, you know, a little bit later on, so what happened is that since they provided source code, I mentioned Jason Kersey before. He actually started a site before he became the owner of Mozilla Zine. He owned a site called Mozbin, and their purpose was to take the source code and compile it and actually give people something they could use, because most people don't have the tools to do that work, at least on Windows, or the time, because it takes about 45 minutes or so to compile. And so, you know, he did that work and posted builds. And so then eventually Mozilla sort of expanded its goals a little bit to actually distribute software to people, but just for testing. And, you know, towards the end of, I guess around the start of 99 or so, expanded to include that. So not just developers, but also for testers. And that turned out to be very successful because, you know, community testers were interested in running the software, running Bleeding Edge. People love to find out what's going on, you know, be ahead of the game, all that sort of stuff. And that turned out to be very successful for reporting bugs. And then as Netscape began to sort of exert more of a stranglehold than even the engineers at Netscape would have liked, Mozilla began to take on the notion that it could perhaps be the organization that ships the pure, or, you know, more usable version of the software that Netscape was shipping. And then, you know, as time went on, Firefox. And I think when the Mozilla Foundation was formed, the mission was to preserve choice and innovation on the internet. And I think that that is a really good mission. That's where they are today. It's nice sort of, it's fairly broad, but it accommodates all of the individual projects that are occurring within the Mozilla project as a whole. You know, internet encompassing not just web, Firefox, but also, you know, email and, you know, chat, things like Chatzilla and stuff like that, and just, you know, various other tools surrounding those projects. So I think that that's that's where the mission is today.
Great. The Spread Firefox website states that Spread Firefox was founded on the same principles of community involvement that drive the development and testing of Firefox. How do open source principles sort of influence those marketing techniques, do you think?
I think it's just a matter of having the thing that makes open source projects, you know, function healthily is good communication and, you know, having projects available that people with spare time will want to contribute to. I think it's difficult for, you know, engineering projects to do that because people who are at this, you know, people who are at the center of a project may not necessarily know what other folk are interested in working on, and, you know, communications can be difficult. But with something like Spread Firefox, a lot of people have enough time to help with some of the marketing projects that they do, and a lot of them don't require that much commitment. And a lot of them are very high payoff and are exciting. So people are interested in it. Not everyone has, you know, programming skill. And it's a way that they can help contribute to supporting a project that they love in a way that suits them.
So have you ever contributed to something on Spread Firefox?
So I haven't contributed to marketing for a while. I did a bunch of marketing work before Spread Firefox was set up, just in terms of making the product pages on Mozilla.org, writing a copy for them, and all that sort of stuff. But since then, mostly engineering, product, and project management, but not so much marketing. I mean, you know, aside from sending in my $50 for the New York Times ad.
And do you think that's because there are marketers who are specifically now working on Spread Firefox?
I think that's because that system seems to be functioning pretty well. And, you know, my time is always fully booked. Well, it's probably booked in excess, so I find some set of things to do. And I try to look at the highest priority things. And marketing isn't the highest priority, but marketing seems like it's being well handled.
Right.
So it doesn't need folk to jump in. And I also think that, you know, there are many more people that are interested in that than engineering. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Could you just very sort of briefly describe sort of the kind of relationship between people working kind of inside for the Mozilla Corporation and people who are working, you know, almost entirely on Mozilla and Firefox projects at other companies like Google or Red Hat or wherever? How is that managed and how does it work?
So this is just my personal opinion, but I don't think it works as well as it could. And this is nothing new. This is nothing new to the Mozilla Corporation. This is something that goes back years. You know, when I worked at the Mozilla Foundation, people would often say, you know, what are you doing? What's going on? We don't know. Tell us. And oftentimes, a lot of these complaints would have a very sort of whiny tone to them, and so people would either not get back to folk, or there was no sort of infrastructure set up for communicating well in an open environment. And I think that that's improving. Especially with the new mailing lists and news groups that we have. I think it's, as someone who's worked both inside and outside, the realization I have now is that there is a night and day difference between being inside and being outside. Because inside, it's an open source project, but in some ways it still functions like a company. In that, you know, if there is somebody sitting over there, you might choose to just talk to that person and reach a design decision rather than going through a public mailing list. And that means that when you do that, everybody else on the outside has no idea what's happened. And then, you know, it seems a surprise, or there's a shock, or why was this change made this way, and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, that's sort of a source of difficulty, and has been. So, yeah, basically we're trying to encourage people to seek to use the open communication systems first now, versus, you know, whatever other means. So there's that. What else?
How about any tensions between you now working still working for on Mozilla projects, but at Google, with the Google side of it? Is there any kind of clash of philosophies or competing motivations?
Within Google, I don't think so. I mean, I think Google is very, Google likes Firefox, and they're very much the attitude that I've seen, at least, has been very, you know, hands off. Like, this has been successful so far, why would we mess with it? So I don't think Google has any sort of interest in causing change, and I don't think it could. I mean, the way that open source works, it's, you know, people would be, you know, upset if something like that would happen. You know, it's not Google's intent to be evil. So, you know, that's my thought there.
How are you doing on time?
Just a couple more minutes.
Okay. Just sort of generally, do you consider open source software projects as a public service? Do you think of it as public service work?
I guess that's interesting. Yeah, I think. I guess I haven't ever used those words to describe it, but I guess so. I mean, that's what they are. I mean, lots of people make software that's free for people to use. I mean, Microsoft made its beta of IE7 available for download for free for Windows users, XP users, and I'm sure that when they're done with IE7, they'll make the final version free as an update to their users. More so, I don't necessarily think that them doing that as a public service, because, you know, they have very clear goals. In addition to it, companies might make statements that they want to do this or that, but if their motivation is something else, it's not really a public service. You know, the mission of Mozilla is to preserve choice and innovation on the internet. Is that with that as its primary goal, yes.
Great. What made you, or even did you, choose public service over maybe a potentially more lucrative job?
I don't think it was necessary. I don't think that's the way that, at least some people think about it. I didn't think about it that way at first. I thought it was, this is something, my angle or reason for doing this was that this is something really useful and interesting. So,
mm-hmm.
Now... You know, after some years, there's also the additional, you know, I feel additional responsibility in terms of in making sure that this continues to work properly. But my initial, point of view was, I didn't really understand open source or anything that well when I started. It was just something that was accessible. So.
So you mostly got into it for interest.
Interest, yeah.
Yeah. What if anything, do you think the popularity of Firefox will do for the open source movement as a whole?
I think Firefox is one of those open source projects that sort of says that this stuff is not just for geeks, this is for everybody, and this is credible. This can be deployed not just across your servers, but to your users. You can, you know, if you've got a you can, you know, roll Firefox out to your entire accounting department and have them use it as their browser, and not just have your system administrators maintain your servers on Linux. And I hope to see more open source projects that focus on things that people can use. Google has been very successful at creating products that people like to use, and, you know, Google's source code for all of that isn't open source, but, you know, clearly there is a demand for usable, interesting software. So I think, you know, open source can benefit from providing that, and not just, you know, sort of either sitting around and waiting for Microsoft or Apple or whoever else to provide it.
Mm-hmm.
it's also sort of distributed. I mean, people are free, much like the web, and, you know, sort of this web 2.0 thing that's going on at the moment. You know, people sort of feel like they can very easily play a part in shaping the future of how things go. And not every project succeeds. Some of them don't turn out to be that useful to a lot of people. But the fact that the sort of liberating people, the open source sort of liberates people to go and pursue their own destinies, I think is positive.
Great. Well, that's just about all we've got. Kind of question for our sake. Outside of sort of current employees and key developers and people's names that we would probably know, is there anything that you think anybody we should talk to who maybe we don't know about already? People who you think would be interesting to talk to that, you know, kind of maybe, you know, haven't been written up in an article on, you know, that's been written somewhere.
Well, so there are a lot of people at Mozilla this week in town, mm-hmm. so you'll probably find a number of people there that would be interesting to talk to and who contribute to various parts of the code from the lowest level to the, you know, highest. One person who is just for, you know, from a different product to Firefox perspective, you know, there is Mike Pinkerton who works on Camino. He's actually in town this week. Whereabouts is Fairfax with respect to DC?
It's right outside, suburb.
Okay, I see. He actually lives in Ashburn.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, so it's actually probably about halfway between Ashburn and DC.
Oh, yeah. So. He lives there and actually works remotely for Google. But he's actually visiting this week. So he's another
great.
He's the leader of the Camino project. So there's another project, and that one's running pretty well. And so he'd be a good person to talk to. But certainly at Mozilla this week, there are some people who contribute to SeaMonkey, some people. Scott McGregor, who works on Thunderbird,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, just all kinds of different perspectives. So, be useful.
Great. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Ben. We took a whole lot of your time, but it was really, really, really interesting. And I think it's gonna be a good addition to the historical record. So,
cool. Well, shall we go find? Since we had to leave this room anyway.